When a suitcase is found in a remote bushland area, its contents would begin a murder investigation that detectives and crime scene examiners would never forget.
She was very enraged about the girlfriend.
We had no bodies, we had no evidence to suggest there had been a crime.
This would have to have been one of the most brutal, vicious incidents I've ever known about as far as murder goes.
When a murder occurs, homicide detectives must explore every possible theory, no matter how remote they may seem. And in this investigation, there were many. Speculation arose about gangs, prostitution, and love triangles, to name but a few. However, only one theory would turn into fact.
Two firefighters told me that over a number of days, there'd been back-burning operations being conducted along the edge of the national park. They were burning off this particular area alongside the roadway, and as they were doing that, they came across what looked like an old suitcase that someone had dumped from the road. They saw that it was still smouldering from the effects of the fire. They also saw that part of the exterior of the bag had been burned away, and some of the items in the bag were also still smouldering. And that's when they went a little bit closer to the suitcase, and they saw that there was a plastic bag in there that was in a round shape. It was at that stage that they made the disturbing find of a human skull within that bag.
The case was several metres from the side of the road. It was a fairly steep incline. I proceeded to record that area by way of taking photographs. The skull itself was in one corner of the suitcase within the remains of a white shopping bag. The size of the skull indicated that it was a small child. I had to go down several metres further into the bush to get a view of the case in the road, and doing that, I've noticed a second case, which was in an area that was unburnt by the fire. Seeing the second case so close to the first case, I considered it would have to be related, although I hoped there wouldn't be a similar finding inside that case as there was in the smaller case.
The two cases were carefully removed and put onto a tarpaulin on the edge of the road for further examination.
The second suitcase was unzipped, and as we began to remove the contents, we immediately saw the remains of an adult female. It was certainly something that was totally unexpected. You know, all of a sudden, we having just got the murder of a child, we've got now a double murder. We began to look closer at the deceased, and I saw that there was also a shopping plastic bag around the head, very similar to how we had located the skull in the first suitcase. As we moved down towards the hand area, we saw that her hands had been bound by a twine. A length of that continued to run further down towards the bottom of the corpse and had also bound the feet together so that she was effectively hogtied.
We then went back to the smaller of the two cases and we removed the remainder of the clothing. While we were doing that, we noted that they're all folded as if the bag had been packed.
As these items were being one by one itemised and removed from the suitcase, the crime scene investigator, all of a sudden, he's come across this third shopping bag and he's began to lift it out of the suitcase, and it was quite evident that it was something cylindrical and, you know, quite evident, I think, even at that stage, that it was a human skull, a third human skull. I remember just looking around and there was just absolute silence. I think everyone was just gobsmacked. Yeah, they couldn't believe that here we already had two deceased persons in these suitcases, and now it appeared that there was going to be a third.
Seeing that the first child in its condition was a little upsetting, but seeing two small children in one suitcase with their ankles bound and plastic bags over the head, for some there was quite upsetting.
Seven Nightly News with Chris Barr. Tonight, Bush Graves, a police search underway after the discovery of three human skulls. Good evening. The discovery of the remains of three bodies sparked a major police operation in New South Wales bushland tonight. Three skulls have been removed for forensic examinations while police check missing persons files.
The gruesome discovery was made near Heaton's Lookout, 11 kilometres south of Cessnock and on the edge of the Wattagon State Forest. The gender and the cause of death are unknown. The bodies could have been at the scene for years.
While the local media speculated that the bodies could be those of several missing women, a post-mortem was being conducted on the female and the two small children to determine the cause of death.
Part of the examination included x-raying that identified no obvious signs of trauma, no obvious evidence of gunshot injury or projectiles either in the remains or in the remains of the suitcases. They looked fairly carefully for evidence of maybe a knife wound, for small nicks and cuts along the edges of bones.
We weren't able to detect any bones broken by the impact of a heavy implement. So they gave up no real evidence as to a cause of death. We then reverted back to the fact that the head of each of the three victims had been encased in a plastic shopping bag, which appeared to have been tied around the neck of each of those three individuals. It was a reasonable assumption that each of the three had been asphyxiated, effectively suffocated, by having plastic bags closed tightly over their heads. When you think of it, a very, very cruel death. We were at a stage of frantically trying to find out who these people were from the little bit of information we had. I was running through my own mind, have we had any mothers and children in the local area go missing that we've been looking for a while? I was unable to think of anything, and equally so, the other police that were with me couldn't conjure up any thoughts of something like that having occurred. So we're starting to think, well, are these people being brought here from some other area?
Now we'll move on to the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, where police are carrying out a major search in the Wattagon State Forest after the discovery of three human skulls. Reporter Richard Lenarduzzi joins us. So they think that it is the bones or the skulls of a woman and two children, is that right?
And speculation is rife at the moment as to who the skulls may belong to. I can tell you that Homicide Squad police are sifting through dozens of missing persons records, but they're focusing on the case of a young woman, her son and daughter, who vanished from Sydney's northern suburbs late last year.
10 months earlier, 31-year-old Susan Park, her three-year-old son Andrew, and daughter Amy, who was only 18 months old, had been reported missing by her sister-in-law, Mina Park. Detectives investigating the triple murder were now hoping she could help them confirm the identity of the three and give them any leads to solve the case.
All right, as you are aware, last week the body of a female and two children was discovered in the Cessnock area. What I'd like to do is show you some photographs of items that were found with those bodies and see if you can tell me anything about those items. Can you tell me anything about that?
That's a Susan's sweater. It's one of her favourites. She wore it many times when we went out. I have many photos of her wearing this.
Do you know if you've seen that particular teddy bear previously?
This teddy bear, my mother, Andrew's grandmother, had bought a white teddy bear about this size for Andrew's birth.
Well, and lastly, I'll show you a photograph of that earring.
I believe I've seen that same earring she wore on the day we went out to shopping. That was about 5 years before she disappeared.
The two had remained good friends, even though Mina's brother Nick had been officially separated from Susan for a month at the time she went missing.
How close a relationship did your brother have with his ex-wife and children?
He would go back and see the children every week or every other week. But I don't know whether they were close enough.
When police first began their investigation into Susan and the children's disappearance, which was 10 months before their bodies were found, they had gone to the flat where Susan lived, and her husband, Nick Park, was there.
I asked Mr. Park where Susan and the children were, and Mr. Park told us that they were with their uncle in Queensland.
They actually flew to Brisbane. They're staying with their uncle at the moment. We want to sell everything and start fresh up there.
So he was selling the goods in the unit and planned on joining them the following day. At that point, we weren't too concerned. We thought it was quite a reasonable explanation. We thought, well, we'll go back and we'll make some inquiries to find out whether or not that was true.
Will you be here the rest of the day, Mr. Park?
Yeah, sure, I'll be packing all day, so I will be here.
And we had contacted Susan's uncle, and he had no knowledge of her whereabouts and, in fact, hadn't spoken to her for about 6 months. At that time, we thought that it was a bit strange that he would lie to us about something like that. We decided that we would go back. There was no answer at this time. We looked through the window. We're unable to see anybody inside the unit. So we decided we'd do a bit of a canvas of the local units, other residents, to see whether or not they might have any information which could help us.
One neighbour told them that the last time she had seen Susan was 11 days before. Susan had mentioned to her that she and Nick might be getting back together. Nick had left Susan because of another woman, but he now, apparently, wanted to make amends.
But he never told that there was another woman involved until the last minute, until about September 96, which was a month before they disappeared.
He had told Susan that he was actually working night shifts and staying at a house with a friend, and that was the reason for him not being home of a night.
So Susan had no idea that Nick had a new girlfriend, even though he'd been going out with her for some 11 months.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I'm aware that Susan allegedly tried to take her own life in around September last year.
Yes.
Is that around the same time as she learnt that Nick had a new girlfriend?
That's about a week after. And at that time, she attempted suicide, I think, by drinking very important alcohol, a lot of it at once. And she rang me about half an hour before she attempted. I went over and then rang the emergency because I thought that, you know, something would have happened to the children.
Police at the time of the original investigation believed it may be possible that Susan had killed the children and then herself. Of course, finding the bodies 10 months later in the state they were in meant that wasn't an option. But there were many other theories about what happened to Susan, Andrew and Amy, and those theories were still being explored.
Can you think of any reason why a Korean crime gang, if there is such a thing, would have reason to harm Susan and the children?
Is that a spider? That's a smart point.
Susan had been married to Nick Park for 4 years. They had met in Brisbane, where Susan worked in her uncle's Chinese restaurant.
Susan was actually of Chinese descent. Nick was Korean. Susan, being of Chinese descent, was, I believe, considered by Nick's mother to be not appropriate for her son. However, Nick's mother was very fond of the grandchildren. So that made up the difference, I think, at that time.
However, 1 month before Susan disappeared, she learnt that her husband had been seeing another woman.
Do you know many of anyone who would have had any reason to harm Susan and the children?
At the time she disappeared, she was very depressed and she was very enraged, I think, about the girlfriend.
Let me in!
Because they had a lot of fights between them, and she went to see Nick, where the girlfriend and Nick was living together in Ashfield, at least two times as I know.
He's my husband!
And there was a lot of confrontation. Nick's girlfriend might have a vengeful motive. That was probably the only person that she ever had fights with. She was a very gentle person.
Nick's girlfriend was only one consideration. Police also learned that Nick was an avid gambler.
I think he was trying to fill up some gap in his life with gambling habit. just like filling up with the alcohol or drugs.
Less than a year before Susan went missing, the temporary Sydney casino opened. Its arrival not only attracted her husband, but there were rumours that loan sharks had also gathered there to prey on unlucky gamblers.
Gang punishment, Korean style. These scenes were filmed in the back streets of King's Cross earlier this year. It shows two young men forced to their knees in a mock show of respect to their attacker, then punched and kicked over money lent for gambling. Korean gangs specialise in loan sharking.
Loan sharking is an insidious activity, and but if there are gangs involved, we want to see them smashed, and we want to see them out of the casino.
There's reportedly two rival gangs fighting over the rights to loan shark at the casino. Both charge exorbitant rates to finance gambling debts. Death is the ultimate price for non-payment.
Since Susan and the children's disappearance, there has been some media speculation in relation to Korean crime gangs in association with their disappearance. Can you think of any reason why a Korean crime gang, if there is such a thing, would have reason to harm Susan and the children?
I know for sure there is a gang, but I don't know what scale and where they're based. But if there are larger scale gangs with money, lending money and distortion and that sort of things, I don't know if there is any personal reason that why Susan and children would be hurt. If she has been hurt by people, maybe if my brother has borrowed money from, it could be possible.
Do you know of any person he owed a large amount of money to?
Not personally, because he was very secretive about his debts. But as far as I knew, if he was in really bad debt, he would usually ask for some money from my mother or myself or other friends.
Right, do you know who he gambled with? Was it any one group of people or person in particular?
I think most of the times, as far as I know, he was by himself.
Nick's gambling debts were one of the first things the original missing persons investigators followed up. At that time, little was known about Korean gangs in or around the casino. So Detective Letchford sought intelligence from overseas, especially America.
The intelligence that came back was suggested there that loan sharks have forced a person who owed them money to force their wife, their girlfriend or their daughter to work in either sweatshops or in brothels to repay the debt.
Police needed to speak with Nick immediately. But when they went to the flat Nick shared with his girlfriend, neither of them were home.
At this stage, we're very alarmed. We took out what's called a pass alert just in case Nick was going to leave the country. That afternoon, we received a phone call from Customs, and they told us that Nick was attempting to leave the country with a female.
We had no offence for which he could be detained at that time. We still weren't sure where Susan and the children were. We requested the Australian Federal Police if they could board the aircraft and perhaps one last time ask Mr. Park where his wife and the children were. Mr. Park again stated his family was in Queensland and that he was returning to Korea to visit a sick relative.
And that he would be returning in 10 days, returning to Sydney. And the federal agent checked his ticket out and his ticket was in fact a return ticket.
And we had no choice at that time but to let him go. After receiving this information, Detective Spur and I both were of the opinion that he was on the run. He had done something or was aware of something that had happened and was fleeing from it.
A worldwide hunt involving Interpol is underway after the identification of three bodies dumped in a New South Wales forest. Police say the victims are a Sydney mother and her two children. Detectives are searching for the woman's husband.
The mother and children disappeared from their Eastwood home unit last October. Interpol's being called in to help find Mrs. Park's estranged husband, Sung, a heavy gambler who owed money to loan sharks.
12 days after Susan and the children had last been seen by their neighbour, Susan's estranged husband, Nick Park, and his girlfriend, Demi, had flown to Korea.
We believe at that time there was possibly two reasons as to why he was fleeing the country. Number one, he had killed his wife and children. And number two, perhaps Susan was being held against her will over some gambling debts of her brother by some Asian gangs, either as a hostage to some late payments or some money owed by Mr. Park, or possibly even placed into a brothel to pay off the debts that Mr. Park had gathered over the years.
Are you aware if Susan was ever a prostitute?
No, no. She had a debt with her uncle when she came to Australia. She had to pay off more than $20,000. She had worked day and night at the restaurants to pay off that debt. I know that she did pay off, and from my knowledge, she would not work as anything other than legal way to pay off whatever, if she had to pay off her husband's debt.
Do you know if that's a common practice in the Korean community?
It's not common practice as such, as you described. But I know for a fact there is people selling people for some purposes, or being kidnapped, or being sold for debt.
If such a situation did eventuate, would the children be involved in that?
Sometimes they do involve children, and they do kidnap children as well as adults.
The reason for that, is that for monetary return? For the return of the people?
It would most probably to do with debt.
We utilise the services of Task Force Oak, which was the Asian Crime Task Force at the time. At our request, they attended a number of brothels in the Sydney metropolitan area with a photograph of Susan, in an effort to perhaps locate her in these premises. We had no joy from that. Nobody at these premises recognised Susan's photograph.
While this theory could not be ruled out at that time, it wasn't furthering the missing persons investigation. And so the detectives moved on to their next scenario, that Nick had murdered his own family.
We obtained a search warrant to look at Mrs. Park's unit at Eastwood. The unit was pretty much in the same state as it was when we were there last time. There was no sheets on the bed, the wardrobes were empty, the furniture was packed in a way that perhaps it was ready to be moved. It actually looked like Mr. Park had not even been back since we had spoken to him.
We searched for signs of anything sinister that may have happened. There was no sign of any struggle. There was no sign of any blood or any other DNA material that we could locate.
Police then moved on to the flat Nick shared with Demi, but the result was the same.
We made some inquiries in relation to Susan's bank accounts, which is what we normally do when people go missing.
Susan had an account with a Commonwealth Bank, and they told us that the account had been activated on the 24th of October, which was about a week after the last sighting of Susan and the children.
$300 had been withdrawn over the counter, which was the entire amount in Susan's account. Detectives also discovered that the children's account had been cleared of $400. It suggested that Susan may be alive. But what was interesting was the fact that the transactions had taken place at a branch that Susan had no reason to attend.
The branch was at Ashfield, which raised our concerns as to why, if it was Susan, she would be making this withdrawal from the Ashfield branch. The only link that she had with Ashfield was that her husband was seeing Demi, who resided in that suburb.
Detectives requested the bank for the CCTV tapes for the purpose of attempting to identify who it was that had made the withdrawal from Susan's account, so we could then find out, yes, Susan is alive and well, or that was somebody else making the withdrawal.
As the detectives waited for the footage, they received a phone call from Susan's neighbour. On the day that Nick had been at Susan's unit selling the furniture, she had noticed that he had thrown a number of documents into a rubbish skip. She thought, with all the police activity, it was worth a look. Inside, she found a letter from a car rental company directed at Nick.
We found out that Nick hired a car on the 19th of October, which was 2 days after the time that Susan was last seen. and he'd not returned the car when he was supposed to.
When the car was hired, the manager told police that Nick was with an Asian woman. Police then showed him a photo of the couple, and he identified Susan as that woman.
She's the one, absolutely certain. She's the one.
And it was extremely important that we located that car to identify who'd been in it, fingerprint it, carried out all forensic service investigations on it to see if any foul play had taken place, whether the vehicle's used to transport bodies or whether Susan and the children are still alive and had just been driven to some safe location.
Because Mr. Park had left the country, we thought a good place to start would be the airport. The vehicle was found and escorted by police to a holding yard. In examining the vehicle, we were looking for anything which might indicate that Susan or the children were in the car. Things such as hair, blood stains, any items of clothing, any identification which might assist us in identifying who had been in the vehicle and what had taken place, if anything, in that vehicle.
There was nothing to indicate to us what had happened to Susan or, in actual fact, whether she'd ever been in the vehicle. Our hopes were dashed pretty well because that was the last avenue where possibly she may have been in the car and driven to some other location. We realised then that Susan and the children had met foul play.
Susan and the children were missing, presumed dead. Susan's husband, Nick Park, had hired a car, left it at the airport and flown to Korea with his girlfriend, Demi. It was no surprise to the police that he hadn't returned to Australia after 10 days, as he had promised.
It was a real possibility at this point in the investigation that Mr. Park could get away with murder. We had no bodies, we had no evidence to suggest there had been a crime. There was nothing to link Mr. Park with their disappearance.
But from past history of such inquiries, eventually something does turn up, be it 12 months or 15 years down the track, something will eventually turn up. And as in this case, it did.
The remains were found 6 metres off the road, all within a 20-metre radius. According to locals, the area was once used as an illegal rubbish tip.
Very rocky, caves and things down there. There's no access at all, so whoever's dumped it down there sort of had the intentions of no one coming across it for years, I think.
Interpol's being called in to help find Mrs. Park's estranged husband, Sung. Mr. Park flew out of the country 6 days after his wife and children vanished from their Eastwood home last October. Police say it's possible the family became the victims of a payback by Asian crime gangs who were after her husband.
From my first involvement on the very first day, there was an inference that crime gang had some involvement in the deaths of Susan and the children. It became obvious to us that we either had to confirm that aspect of the investigation or refute it. If not, it would have been raised later at trial as a possibility. We enlisted the support of two specialist investigators from the Southeast Asian Crime Command. There was nothing to indicate from any of their inquiries that Nick Park had an extensive association with crime gangs. There was nothing to indicate that he'd ever borrowed large amounts of money from loan sharks that frequented the casino at that time. And there was nothing to indicate that any crime gang had any involvement in the disappearance and subsequent murder of Susan and the children.
With that theory put to bed, police concentrated on finding evidence to link their prime suspect, Nick Park, to the murders.
From the outset of the investigation, we didn't have a crime scene. We couldn't prove where Susan, Andrew and Amy had been initially murdered. It was obvious to us that they'd been transported to the scene where they'd been found, obviously in the suitcases.
Inside those cases were clothing and other items that belonged to the three victims and came from their flat. Now the plastic bags that had been used as murder weapons were adding to an argument that the murder took place there.
We were lucky enough to find batch numbers on those plastic bags. We were able to identify a shop at the Macquarie Centre at Marsfield where those bags had been supplied. We subsequently showed photographs of Susan to the proprietor of that shop, who did recognise her as being quite a regular shopper, and that led us to believe that Susan, Andrew and Amy had been murdered at the Eastwood unit.
The only other person to have access to the flat was Nick Park. However, police needed to find further direct links between Nick, those items and the place the bodies had been found.
After we located the suitcase, we noticed that we had some tyre tracks that were dried into the road verge. the time of year it had been fairly dry, so I was reasonably confident these tracks had been made sometime before because they were quite hardened. And I'm thinking, is this tyre track related to the vehicle that possibly pulled up here?
The car hired by Nick was repossessed and re-examined by the police. But the tyres did not match those at the scene, nor were there any signs that the suitcases had been in the boot.
If we could prove that the suitcases at some stage had been in the boot of that vehicle, then we've had a very strong case against Nick.
But their return to the car meant that they re-interviewed the manager. This time they showed him 16 photos of different Asian women. And instead of picking Susan, he went directly to a photo of Demi.
It wasn't a surprise to us that Demi was with Nick at the time the vehicle was hired. Whether Demi was aware of the purpose the vehicle was being hired was unknown to us at that stage.
We didn't believe at that time that she had any direct involvement in their disappearance, but we were of the opinion that perhaps information that she might have obtained from Mr. Park, seen or overheard, could assist our inquiry.
Demi was not only seen at the car rental place, but also at the bank. When police viewed the CCTV footage on the day that $300 was taken from Susan's account, Demi was there. Police then obtained the withdrawal slip from that day and the ones used to close the children's accounts a few days before.
Susan, the mother, was the only signatory to those accounts. We subsequently subjected them to handwriting analysis by a police expert who confirmed that the signatures on the documents were obvious forgeries.
Those slips were then sent to the forensic laboratory to see if any fingerprint could be lifted.
When I received the forms, because they were a paper document, which is a porous surface, I determined that the most effective means of developing latent fingerprints on those items was using a process called ninhydrin. Ninhydrin is also a very sensitive chemical reagent that reacts with porous surfaces. On the document in the name of Andrew Park, I could see that there was a clearly identifiable palm print at the bottom of the document, which appeared to be a left palm.
Demi had no criminal record, and so there were no prints on file to compare. Nick, on the other hand, was a different story.
Nick Park, in his younger days, had come under notice of police for a minor fraud matter. His fingerprints were on our records. When we identified the palm print from the withdrawal slip of Andrew Park, that was cross-matched against our database, and it was indicated that the palm print was that of Nick Park's. This confirmed to us that that Nick had been involved in the closure of the children's accounts the day after we believed that they had been murdered.
In those days after, police confirmed that Nick had also sold furniture, had pawned goods.
And I just went to find out. I mean, we paid $50 on the 14th.
And had even asked for a refund on monies paid in advance for his children's childcare.
Is that possible for us to get a refund for that?
Whilst it was always a possible motive for Susan and the children's murder that Nick was trying to raise money quickly, the amounts of money Nick was obtaining from the sale of these items was quite small. It seemed a fairly long bait to draw that a guy would kill his wife and two children for the purposes of raising perhaps a couple of $1,000.
Police needed to find a motive, and in most homicides, it comes down to love or money. And as police continued their investigation into gathering enough evidence to have Nick Park extradited from Korea, it was clear which one it was.
To your knowledge, are Nick and his girlfriend still living together or still seeing each other in Korea?
One of the things you look for in an investigation is to why a crime was committed. We had trouble coming to the terms with the fact that a father had killed their three-year-old son and two-year-old daughter. He could have always left Australia and travelled to Korea with Demi without harming Susan and the children. It became obvious to us that some catalyst to the violence must have taken place. So a large part of our investigation was conducted in an attempt to try and identify that catalyst.
When Susan had overdosed on her ginseng wine, she had been admitted to hospital and came under the care of a psychologist.
The psychologist had
indicated to Susan she should try and look after herself and her future and that of the children. The psychologist had urged Susan to apply for child support and had facilitated putting her in contact with the child support agency to try and claim ongoing support from Nick. We contacted the child support agency. They prepared a letter addressed to Nick Park at the Ashfield address on the 15th of October, which was posted on the 16th of October and was most likely received at the Ashfield unit on the 17th of October. It was considered at that stage that could have been the catalyst for Nick to confront Susan.
While it was all circumstantial, police believed they had enough evidence to extradite Nick Park from South Korea to face the charges of murder. They just had to find him.
To your knowledge, are Nick and his girlfriend still living together or still seeing each other in Korea?
From what I heard from my brother, they had broken up a while ago.
Nick's contact with his family was sporadic.
He rang me on reverse charge in May or early June. At that time, he had started to work in James Rose English School in Bijangbu in Korea.
When Korean police checked, he had left there and gone underground.
For the purpose of this interview, can you state your full name?
My name is Song On.
But perseverance paid off, and exactly 1 year and 7 months after police believed Nick Park had killed his wife and children, he was back in Australia facing those charges.
Would you agree that early this morning Detective Woods and I escorted you back from Seoul into the Republic of Korea?
Yes.
And we arrived back in Australia at about 2:15 this morning?
Yeah.
And we came straight here to the Surrey Hills police station?
Yes, we did.
Well, what I propose to do is ask you some questions in relation to the alleged murder of your wife and your son Andrew Park and your daughter Amy Park. Do you have any objections to answering those questions?
Yes, actually, I'm not going to answer any questions today.
So is it the case, Mr. Park, that at this stage, under legal advice, you don't wish to answer any questions?
Yes, this.
All right. Is there anything further at all you wish to say about this matter?
No.
While Nick wasn't talking, his ex-girlfriend, who was still in Korea, was happy to tell police what she knew.
Demi told us that on the 17th of October, Nick received a letter from the child support agency at the Ashfield unit. Upon opening this letter and seeing that Susan was applying for ongoing child support for her and the children, Nick became enraged. Demi indicated that Nick went to the Eastwood unit. He rang Demi at about 3 or 4 a.m. on the morning of the 18th of October, where he told Demi that their problems had finished and everything would be okay. Early in the morning, Nick then returned to the Ashfield unit, where Demi was waiting for him.
On that day, Nick put in the withdrawal papers for the children's accounts, leaving his palm print. The following day, Demi admitted she was with Nick when he hired the car.
Demi told us that after they'd hired the motor vehicle, they attended the flat at Eastwood that night. Demi stayed in the car while Nick went to the unit. He returned to the car with two suitcases. Nick placed those suitcases into the boot of the vehicle. They then drove to an area north of Sydney. She was unsure of the exact location as to where they stopped, but she described a bushland area with a dirt road. Nick stopped the vehicle and threw the two suitcases into the bush. They then returned to Sydney. Demi confessed that she had attended the Commonwealth Bank and withdrawn $300 from Susan's account by forging her signature, which was all done at Nick's request.
Nick accumulated $2,225 after he callously murdered his family and flew out of Australia believing he would never return.
We'd always believed that the money Nick had raised from closing the bank accounts
selling the furniture and pawning property, had been used to purchase airline tickets for himself and Demi to travel to Korea. However, Demi indicated in this interview that the money had actually been used for Nick to go to the casino and gamble.
Demi was offered immunity from the fraud charges if she gave evidence against Nick at his trial. However, she was given no indemnity should the decision be made to prosecute her for any involvement in the murders. Staying in Korea was the safe option. But Demi attended court of her own accord.
The fact that Demi returned to Australia of her own free will to give evidence in the trial of Nick confirmed to me that she had no involvement in the murders of Susan and the children.
No charges were laid against Demi, and she is now back living in Korea. Her witness account, along with the other circumstantial evidence, was enough for a jury to find Nick guilty of killing Susan, Andrew, and Amy.
It was very pleasing to see that that the perpetrator in this case was brought back to Australia, stood trial, found, was convicted and jailed.
Nick Park was sentenced to 26 years. His earliest parole date is 2017.
This would have to have been one of the most brutal, vicious killings that I can recall. I've seen persons shot dead. I've seen them bashed. But to murder two little children and the mother, I think that's one of the worst incidents I've ever known about as far as murder goes. I've devastated Watson Hill.